Public Affairs, today, May 8, 2003. And colleagues, looks like the order of our agenda today will be a public hearing on House Bill 3631. And then as we wait for the members that are currently up in the chamber for some work that they're doing in carrying various bills, once they return, we will return to work session on that bill. After the public hearing on 3631, we will do Senate Bill 457, and then go up to House Bill 2144, and end it with Senate Bill 137. So with that, let's open up the public hearing on House Bill 3631. Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Representative Bill Garrard, District 56, Klamath Falls. I'm here in support of House Bill 3631. This bill is all about righting a wrong that was committed against the young lady who sits right next to me. This is about the American dream and a woman who will not stop her fight to achieve it. As chair of the Environment and Land Use Committee, I first heard about Dorothy English. We tried but failed with the Forest Park bill to restore her rights. That's why we are back in front of a committee today, your committee, with a new bill and another chance for this body to do what I believe to be the right thing. I appreciate the opportunity to have spoken with you today, but the lady to my right is what this is all about.
Thank you. Mr. Honeycutt, do you have any opening statement?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt speaking in support of 3631. But before I speak, why don't, if it's acceptable to the committee, why don't we let Dorothy English go ahead and tell you a little bit about her situation, and then I can clarify some of the loose ends.
Okay, great. Ms. English, welcome.
Hello, thank you very much for listening to me today. My husband and I bought this property in 1953. It didn't have water, didn't have inside plumbing, but because we thought the 40 acres, new property, this was a chance to have the American dream. All right, the first thing we did was put in a water system, then started building a new house. We had an old one to live in. We saved our money each year for each step to build this house. When we had enough money, we did the foundation, and there on down until the last nail my husband pounded. We owned it. To me, that's worth fighting for 30 years, which we did, and now I'm doing, and I always will. Number one, we had 40 acres, and we put our house on one end of it. Then there's a ridge that goes east and west that is the very best view property. We decided, well, we need the plan for our retirement. We were around 50 plus at that time. We surveyed off the property with the idea we had grandkids little. When they grew, if we wanted to give them a home site, our daughter, who had always taken care of us and us her, and along came LCDC. Now, number one, my definition of LCDC is poor man's eminent domain. They take possession of your property like they have mine. They don't pay you a penny. They control it like they have mine. Now, if that isn't poor man's eminent domain, at least eminent domain pays you when they take your property. Now, they let us pay taxes and live on it. And while I'm on the subject of taxes, I have never been on deferral of any kind. Everybody else in Section 32 that I'm in are on either forest or farm deferral. And I'm entitled to what I call old people's deferral. I'm not on that either. I pay my full share of taxes. We always have. We always will. Because, number one, I don't want anybody else with their foot on my neck telling me what to do with my property. I've had it up to here. Now, Dave, do you want to have something to say there for a minute?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt again in support of 3631. Let me tell the committee a little bit about what 3631 does and why it is that we're here in front of the legislature as opposed to trying to resolve this problem at Multnomah County. House Bill 3631 has four different sections. The first three sections deal with Forest Park and the area around Forest Park. Forest Park, I believe, is the largest urban park in the United States. It's right. It's within the, I believe, within entirely within the city of Portland city limits, if not almost entirely within the city of Portland city limits. So the first three sections of the bill essentially create what's known as a Goal 5 designation for Forest Park in the area surrounding Forest Park. Goal 5 is LCDC, Land Conservation and Development Commission's Natural Resources Goal. LCDC can require cities and counties to, under Goal 5 to go out and map areas and declare those areas as significant resource sites for open spaces or scenic views or wildlife habitat or aggregate or what have you. This bill does not do that. It does indicate that the area is a significant resource site, but then section 3 or section 2 sub 3 of the bill is all permissive. It tells the, or it says to the cities and the counties, in this case particularly the city of Portland and Multnomah County along with Metro, the regional government, you may go out and determine the boundaries of this area. You may prepare summaries. You may adopt ordinance requirements to protect the area. You may do all of these things, but you don't have to. City of Portland and Multnomah County on Dorothy's property, and I think all of the most, if not all of the property around Forest Park already has Goal 5 overlay zones on the, in those properties. So the first three sections of the bill essentially do what's currently being done in that area right now. Section 4 of the bill is the portion of the bill that, as Representative Girard testified, rights or wrong. You've all heard, I assume, in the last week or 2 weeks that there are a number of, quote, special interest land use bills floating around this building, and for those of us who have been around here for a few sessions and understand and have been involved in the land use process, I think it's shocking to me that they would even complain about that. Every single land use bill, if you go out and you try and make a significant policy change, and of course it's my opinion, it may not be yours, but it's my opinion that we need significant policy changes in the land use system in this state. But setting that aside, if you go out and actually try and make a significant policy change, then the argument is that this is that you're gutting Oregon's land use system, or this is extreme. So what inevitably ends up happening, at least on every bill that I've ever worked on, is that the bill gets narrowed, and at some point it gets narrowed to the point where it affects a few, if not one or two particular landowners, and then the same people that argued that the policy change was too big then come in and argue that it's a special interest bill. And so you really, for I can't think of another term, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And so what we've done with this particular bill is try to draft amendments that, or try to draft a bill that deals particularly with Ms. English's property. I'd love to do more, and if the committee would like to broaden the scope of the bill to solve other folks' problems, we'd certainly be thrilled with doing that. But it's of all of the people that I've dealt with over my years working in the land use field, and of all of the people when we've gone out with Measure 56, our notice measure, our administrative rules measure, or Measure 7, or any of the other things that we've done, and I talk to thousands of landowners every year, of all the people that I've talked to, I think Dorothy English is the most egregious example of the land use system gone wrong. They've taken this lady's entire life savings and her entire investment, her and her husband, and have decimated it. Now, she lives on her property, but her daughter lives with her to help her, essentially to help her pay the property taxes, and I think that's outrageous. The reason we're here and not at, there's two reasons actually that we're here and not at Multnomah County, and why this is the only body that can deal with this issue. Dorothy English's land is in a commercial forest zone, and under LCDC's Goal 4, all areas that were zoned for commercial forest use at the time that their plans were acknowledged are automatically deemed forest land. So Dorothy's land is deemed forest land, and I don't believe that there's a way that we could get what's known as an exception to get her land out of a forest zone, because under Goal 4, if it was forest land as of the day that their plan was acknowledged, it's forest land. Her land was in a forest zone as of the day that Multnomah County's land use plan was acknowledged, and so I don't think we can get her out of a forest zone, even though there isn't a commercial forest operation for miles around her property. And there won't be any commercial forest operations occurring on her property or any other properties around it. It's a rural residential area. People move out there because of the views and because they want to live in the country. So we can't, even if Multnomah County wanted to help, which I don't believe that they do, there wouldn't be anything that they could do to help Dorothy. Now, the second reason we're here, you have a state statute that was created in 1993 and that limits parcel sizes in the forest zone to 80 acres. So the minimum parcel size in a forest zone is 80 acres. As long as that state statute is in place, the only place that we can come to allow Dorothy to divide her property, to give some to her, to give a couple of parcels to her grandkids so they can live up on the property near her, and also to invest, to sell some so that she can live a comfortable retirement, is to come to the legislature. It's a state statute that prohibits her from dividing her property, along with the Multnomah County ordinance and an LCDC rule. So there's three layers, but as long as the state statute's in place and as long as her land is in a commercial forest zone, the only place that we can come to solve that problem is here. And so that's why we're here. We have the Dash 1 amendments that we've prepared that further narrow the people that are entitled to protection or that are entitled to relief under this act. We would certainly support the Dash 1 amendments if the committee so chooses. If the committee wants to run the bill out without the Dash 1 amendments, that would be fine with us as well. But the Dash 1 amendments, I believe, narrow the scope of the bill even more so that any concerns by any of the opponents to this measure that this actually affects more than this particular piece of property, I think would be satisfied. Again, we'd love to make this broad, but from experience, it's frustrating, and that's a battle I'd just as soon not fight if the committee is so inclined.
I think what I'd like for you to do is maybe hold on the amendment until we're in work session and we have all members here to talk about it. So sure. I'll just call you back up to explain that amendment at that time. Okay. Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
I just want to make sure I understand. Is there any connection in physical connection between Forest Park and Ms. English's land?
No.
Are they close by each other, or?
No. Well, the only connection there is because we're near it, but not against it.
I see. Thank you.
Jared Doyle, Representative Barnhart. One of the things that the earlier version, there was an earlier version of this bill. It was House Bill 2905, Representative Greenlick's bill. And you'll see this in Section 2 of 3631. The bill also applied to wildlife corridors. The area of influence could, if the local governments chose to do so, include wildlife corridors. As Ms. English testified when she was in front of Representative Garrard's committee in the Environment and Land Use Committee, there are elk and deer on her property, usually eating her rose bushes while they look at her through the window.
Mr. Chair, just one quick comment for the committee. Mrs. English is 91 years old.
I'm past the half mark, so. Well, and of course the wildlife corridor, you know, we've been in the wildlife corridor ever since we've been up there. That isn't anything new. We have to shoot the coyotes so they won't kill our cats and bury them, because Multnomah County told me they didn't have any money budgeted to take care of the animals. And I said, well, don't worry about it. We'll take care of them. And if they want a permanent home at our property, we'll make one for them. We'll shoot them and bury them. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
I'm
going to
take
it to
other
places. Mr. Susan Miller. Sorry, Susan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. You may not be surprised to hear that we do not support House Bill 3631. We don't have a position on Sections 1 through 3 of the bill relating to Forest Park. However, we oppose Section 4 of the bill, and therefore the bill as a whole, for two main reasons. First of all, we do believe that it seriously undermines Oregon's land use program for the legislature to pass bill after bill addressing specific local issues that affect individual landowners. And we believe the legislature should set broad policy rather than reaching down to the local level to rezone particular pieces of property or specify the location of particular urban growth boundaries or the like. Second, we have concerns about Section 4 of the bill, which would order Multnomah County to allow specific landowners to subdivide their forest land for large lot dwellings. I think it's pretty clear that this language was drafted with one particular landowner in mind, Mrs. English, who just testified. We've done a little bit of research. It's our understanding that Mrs. English and her husband first purchased this property in 1953 for about $4,500. They later subdivided and sold off approximately half the property in, I think, more than one subdivision. So the property that started out around 39 acres, or maybe it was 40, is now approximately 20 acres or slightly less. The 20 remaining acres were assessed in 2000 to have a value of approximately $200,000. I assume the value is even higher now, or slightly higher. This does not include the value of the dwelling. This does not include the value of the property that was sold off. So assuming that the cost of the portion of the original parcel that was not subdivided and sold was approximately half the original cost, $2,250, then the value of the current property has increased over 80 times since it was purchased, or taking inflation into account, it's about 14 times higher than its original purchase price. So, again, not taking into account the previous subdivision and sale of half the property, not taking into account the value of the house on the property, that doesn't seem to be a particularly compelling fairness issue from our perspective. And as I think Multnomah County can testify about whether this language either in the bill as written or the language of the amendment apply to just this property or to numerous properties throughout Multnomah County. So, at any rate, we do not support the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Doyle and committee members. My name is Susan Muir. I am the interim planning director for the Multnomah County Land Use and Transportation Section. I'm here on behalf of the Multnomah County Commission to testify about Section 4 of the proposed bill. And I would like to let you know that Multnomah County has a history of doing community-based rural land use plans that we've worked on over the last 8 years. These plans have taken years to create with intensive public involvement, compliant with the ballot measure 56 proposal that Oregonians in Action passed through the state. We used public hearings, adoption by the Board of County Commissioners, and acknowledgement by the state of Oregon. For each of those plans, the county mailed individual notice to each property owner potentially affected by the plan and invited them to attend public meetings and participate as part of Citizen Task Force to help the staff develop the plans to recommend to the Board of County Commissioners. The effects of the language as proposed will essentially undo the work Multnomah County has done with citizens over the last 8 years in building these plans. Statewide Planning Goal 1 calls for the opportunity for citizens to be involved in all phases of the planning process. The language would reduce the already limited supply of forest land in Multnomah County, and Multnomah County values the contribution forest management makes to the diversity of the industrial economy of the county and of the state. Protection of these forest land base also helps to support jobs in the rural areas of Multnomah County and in adjacent counties as well. We have no detailed analysis about how many additional lots this would create in Multnomah County at this time. Ownership data that we have doesn't go back any farther than 1977. We have some data back to that point. But we have unknown impacts about the infrastructure services and additional impacts to other statewide planning goals. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about this.
Any questions? Representative Berger?
I want you to verify for me that if a person bought property in 1955 and it was in any category, regardless, this happened to be forest land, but any category, that that category would not change, nor would there ever be an exception taken to that category.
Chair Doyle, Representative Berger, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay. I buy some property in 1955, and you have it categorized as forest land. No matter what happens in the next decades, that property will always be categorized as forest land, and there will not be an exception to that. If that property were to change, unchanged, whatever.
Chair Doyle and Representative Verger, there are processes within the statewide system that allow for exceptions to Goal 4 or the commercial forest use zoning. There are criteria that a particular property would need to meet in order to get an exception to that. So there are ways that properties can be taken out of protected forest zoning.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Has this particular property owner tried to get an exception to Goal 4?
Chair Doyle and Representative Verger, I don't believe so.
Has Multnomah County offered to assist this property owner in trying to get an exception to Goal 4?
Chair Doyle and Representative Verger, the process that we went through with what we call the West Hills Rural Area Plan started in 1995, and that was our opportunity to sort of check and see, are things correctly zoned in the rural area, and are there any opportunities or needs to update what we have? And we did make some changes at that time. It was not decided by the board to change this particular property at that time. So there was an opportunity. This was one of the plans where we did mail notice to all property owners to get them into that process so that if there was an opportunity or a need to rezone or try and take exceptions to statewide planning goals, that would be the process that we would have done that in.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. That's all. Oh, no. Doug Riggs, can you come forward?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Doug Riggs. I'm here today on behalf of Metro. We were planning to be here to testify on an amendment that we had requested to the bill on page 2, section 3, which would have revised lines 21 through 23. And unfortunately, through a miscommunication between our legislative office and ourselves, the amendment was never actually submitted to be drafted. And so as a result, we cannot support the bill as currently written. Let me tell you what the amendment would do. If you look at lines, page 2, lines 22 and 21 and 22, it notes that a particular area may not be included by a local government into an urban growth boundary. And we think that that is a terrible precedent to set. Metro has consistently opposed bills that would force local governments to bring land into the UGB, and by the same token, we think it's responsible to oppose bills that prevent local governments from bringing land into the UGB. So it's a consistency argument, and we have spoken with both Representative Greenlick's office as well as OIA, and they've both agreed to the amendment. They have no objections to it. So what I would like to do is just let you know on the record that I cannot support the bill as written. There is apparently a commitment to fix it in the Senate, and we would look forward to working with the sponsors of the bill on that, to that end. Thank you.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Hanekat, want to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dave Hanekat, just very briefly, we have had conversations with Metro and certainly don't oppose their amendment and would certainly be fine with including that if they choose to do so on the Senate side. That's not a problem. I just wanted to respond to two things and then to address Representative Verger's question. I believe it was Ms. Muir that said that the forest land contributes to the Multnomah County's rural economy. That's probably true, but in this particular area, as we testified earlier, there is no forest commercial forest activity going on. There hasn't been, and there won't be, because the parcels are all small and they're dotted with rural residences. This is a rural residential area. It's not. We're not talking about warehouse or forest land. This is a rural residential area of 5, 10, 20 acre parcels with homes on them. So those people aren't, there are no commercial forest activities going on in this area to contribute to a rural economy, to a rural forest economy. And by the way, this land is 3/4 of a mile from the city of Portland city limits. And so I don't see any commercial forest activities going on in that. To respond very quickly to Representative Verger's question about the exception, obviously Dorothy English has been involved in with the process at every step, and every time Multnomah County has a hearing, she gets involved. But she won't qualify for an exception to the forest goals in Goal 4. Not only has Multnomah County not helped her, but even if they could, she wouldn't qualify because the land was zoned for forest use as of the date that Multnomah County's comprehensive plan was adopted. And what Goal 4, what LCDC's Goal 4, its forest land goal says, is that forest land includes all lands that were zoned for forest as of the date of the acknowledgement of the county's comprehensive plan. Well, her land was forest at that time, so it's going to, under LCDC's Goal 4, looking at the definition of forest land, it will always be zoned for forest purposes under the definition of that goal. So even if she wanted to try and take an exception, I don't think she could.
Representative Berger.
David, are there no exceptions to Goal 4?
You can get an exception. I've actually been involved, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I've actually been involved in taking an exception to Goal 4 in Deschutes County, but the only way that happened was that Deschutes County specifically adopted a provision. They amended their comprehensive plan. They did that legislatively, and then the way that they had amended their comprehensive plan authorized the taking of exceptions. LCDC then acknowledged their amendment to their comprehensive plan, and we were able to do that. But Multnomah County hasn't chosen to amend their comprehensive plan to allow for the taking of an exception to Goal 4, at least not as far as I'm aware.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Let's then go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3631 And as I said earlier, colleagues, we will wait for, if now Representative Post, to get from the floor before we have a work session there. We're going to open up 457, but I don't think we have people here yet to... Okay. let's stand at ease since we only have a couple of minutes to wait. Okay. Amanda, we'll stand at ease. Reconvene the House Rules and Public Affairs Committee and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 457. Senator Devlin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. And thank the chairman in particular for his indulgence with this. We're waiting for our key witness, and I was planning to testify for about 2 or 3 minutes, and I'll try to stretch that to about 4 minutes, since he seems to be about 8 minutes behind. But, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 457, a bill sponsored by Senator, or I should say Representative Miller and myself. It's a relatively small bill. This bill modifies the number of signatures required on a petition to request a municipal audit from 10 residents to 30 residents in a municipality with a population of more than 150 residents. According to ORS 297.425, all municipal corporations are required to be audited and reviewed at least once each calendar year or fiscal year. Municipal corporations are exempt from these audits should they fulfill the requirements stated in ORS 297.435 and are only subject to providing a financial statement to the Secretary of State. The City of River Grove, Oregon, population 320, meets these requirements and therefore submits yearly financial statements to the Secretary of State. Oregon Statute 297.445 states that municipal corporations can be subject, however, to a municipal audit should a petition signed by 10 residents of the municipality who are subject to the taxes, fees, assessments, or other charges levied by the municipality be submitted to the Secretary of State within 6 months of the end of the fiscal year for which the audit is requested. All costs for the conduct of the audit are incurred by the municipality. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, how this bill came forward is Representative Miller and I both share one of the smallest cities in the metropolitan area, the City of River Grove. And for over the past 3 years now, a Washington developer has battled the city of River Grove over land use ordinances, essentially claiming that the city has no authority to require development permits of him for such things as construction of a quarter-mile-long sewer line, an 800-foot-long rock and steel wall, excavation of hundreds of yards of fill in the floodplain, installation of a power pole to serve a non-permitted mobile home, removal of 30-year-old fences and encroachment upon adjacent neighbor's land with fences that are 15 feet high. This developer has basically told the city 3 years ago that he had a $250,000 legal budget, which he intended to use to bankrupt the city. You have to understand that the general fund for the city of River Grove last year was less than $30,000. He has appealed all three of their denials of his development permit applications to the Land Use Board of Appeals. The city has prevailed in all three times with LUBA affirming the city's decision. He sued the River Grove three times in district court. Their most recent victory, the city's victory, on December 9th to defending his two mandamus actions against city. City won and the judge awarded the city's attorney's fees. The city has not collected particular party's judgment proof. Prior awards of attorney's fees and prior actual actions against other groups in terms of awarding fees to them have still been not paid by the party. The developer's most recent attempt to basically incur problems for the city of River Grove was found in ORS 297445, which I mentioned to you as the subject of this bill. By simply getting 10 signatures from people that are in one of his developed parcels, he has required the city to do an audit. And I have to tell you that the audit, we believe, will cost the city. We can do nothing about the current audit. It'll cost the city between $2,000 and $3,000. You have to know that the city's financial books look probably much less significant than the average individual that's here in this room. They write four to five checks a month. And so that this bill will not impact this current audit is underway. So Representative Miller and I were looking for a potential solution, at least so we could get the sentiments of the citizens themselves of whether an audit was required. And the solution we came to was to modify this law so that in cities larger than 150 or municipal corporations, because it could include a special district, that it would require 30 signatures, still a very low number of signatures, but it's a small amount of relief for the city of River Grove. The Secretary of State's office has reviewed this. They are neutral on it. The League of Oregon Cities is strongly in favor, and I believe they will testify here later today and submit a letter in support. Raising the signature requirement in no way will prevent the citizens of River Grove from seeking an annual audit if they truly wish to do so. What it will do, though, is make the annual audit process or the requirement for it in a city that is this small truly reflective of what the original purpose was, is where the citizens of the city have legitimate concerns. And gathering, say, 30 signatures in those cases should not be difficult. You may ask why we chose the figure 30 and why we chose the figure over 150. Well, basically, we looked at the municipal corporations, particularly cities, which is where this is more likely to occur, and it seemed like a natural cutoff point and a much easier one to administer than actually giving the Secretary of State a certain percentage of residents, something like that, because it's actually a percentage of residents, not a percentage of registered voters. That is the bill. The bill is a very small bill, passed overwhelmingly in the Senate, and I hope for your positive consideration. Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'll introduce Mayor Barrett here. Mayor Barrett is the mayor of River Grove. For the chair's indulgence, Mr. Barrett does not hold the same political affiliation I do. In fact, Mr. Barrett at one time ran in a primary to potentially oppose me. So we can tell you there's no hard feelings.
Nice move.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with the committee today. One little piece of information I might add that, as Senator Devlin has mentioned, we have won six times with this particular developer. Three times we've been affirmed at LUBA. Three times we won in district court, defending ourselves, of course. He has, since that time, appealed the district court's decision to the appellate court. He won't win, but it'll cost us a lot of money to take it there. And he's put us on notice that he's going to hit us for an 11-count tort of federal violation of his federal civil rights. So it will be an ongoing thing, and that's fine, and you know, we should be able to work with these. As difficult as it is, we understand that anybody with $25 can sue anybody else, and as a municipality, we take on that burden. But this particular law, ironically, he hasn't been able to affect us in the courts. He hasn't been able to withstand the land use decisions that we've made at our local level. LUBA has affirmed us every time. But he can audit us into oblivion the way the law exists right now. We have a budget of $28,000 in our city. 100% of our revenues, we levy no taxes of any kind. 100% of our revenues come from our fair share of cigarette liquor taxes. In short of encouraging Oregonians to smoke or drink more, our revenues are etched in stone and they won't go up. And all of our budget is spent on lighting and police services and emergency services and a little bit of legal funds, which of course are tied up for many years to come now with the litigation. We have a tremendous city attorney that's working with us in our legal problems. But we have no extra money for continued and ongoing unnecessary audits. I believe in the necessity to have audits as a part of state law that all municipalities should be subject to, but it certainly should be reasonable. I don't have any problem anytime anyone ever wants to come in and look at our books, private citizens, get their own auditors, go through us upside down and backwards. It'll take them 15 minutes to do it and see where we are, and that's just fine. But the particular law that requires a municipality to audit, it's a full-blown audit. The CPA firm that we're engaged with now, who's giving us a break on the cost, because they're getting some pro bono work done by some other CPAs that are going to help them out. It's extensive, the work that they have to do according to the law. So this particular law, we don't believe that this particular developer can convince 30 people to audit us. And so we ask for your consideration accordingly. I'll answer any questions if you have some for me.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you. Appreciate you coming down for that too. Thank you, Senator. Michelle Deister.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. And the previous two witnesses said it better than I ever could. I just want you to know that the League of Oregon Cities is in support of this bill because we do believe that it maintains several measures of accountability as described by both Senator Devlin and Mayor Barrett. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I have a question of you. I'm kind of curious on this demand for audit and getting the signatures. Is there not at some point a nuisance law that falls into effect where you demand, or can you just... I'm not familiar. I've not had that experience, but I just wonder if you can actually put a city through that kind of expense without any kind of nuisance provision.
Yeah, and personally, I'm not aware of what mechanism a city would have to avoid nuisance actions beyond making their presentations to a court on an individual action. And I think what's happened with this city, they keep getting their attorney fees awarded.
Right.
And it doesn't matter when the guy isn't there to pay off the judgment. So, but I don't know beyond that. Okay, we can close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 457. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 457. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 457 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 457 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Representative Monica Sanderson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Were you aware, maybe I should have asked the people, why
the four people who voted, and it was bipartisan, who voted nay on the bill last time in the Senate.
I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion? Okay. Further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, let's call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Chair votes aye. Senate Bill 457 passes with to the floor of the due pass recommendation, and we will have Representative Miller carry this bill. That closes the work session on Senate Bill 457. And was there anybody to speak on this? Okay, let's open up then a public hearing on Senate Bill 137. And all of his colleagues, I said we would probably take 2144 before this, but we do have Mr. Neal here to testify on 137.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Fred Neal. I'm campaign finance manager for the Oregon Elections Division, Secretary of State's office, and also the voters' pamphlet supervisor. Senate Bill 137A engrossed passed the Senate to do two things. One, in regards to candidate photos for the state voters' pamphlet, allow that photograph to be up to slightly just under 4 years of age instead of just under 2 years of an age. And certainly many of the committee members in Senate rules had formerly been in the House of Representatives and were painfully reminiscent of the trials of trying to get a new photograph every time you ran for re-election in the House. And so this bill allows for an extension of that, and your professional photograph fees are good for 4 years under Senate Bill 137 as engrossed. Section 2 of the bill nails down to our satisfaction more carefully the requirement that came out of the legislature 2 years ago in regards to the names and titles of the officers of or of organizations or of public officials in regards to statements of endorsement, so that the candidate's statements or major arguments accurately reflect what the true name, title, and of officers and organizations are. I have brought to the committee for their edification copies of our sample of our statement of endorsement form. You've used it. This is the one we adopted for the general election last year, realizing that we had some technical difficulties in trying to implement Representative Walker's bill from last session. And the final thing that 137 does is apply those state statement of endorsement requirements to county voters' pamphlets so that the same set of regulations apply for local voters' pamphlets as well as the states. And you'll see in this SEL 400 form that there's a box, and we're pretty clear about in this box type or print the name of the person and or organization. Person is authorized to represent exactly as it should appear in the voters' pamphlet statement or argument. An organization's name should be used only if the organization is endorsing the argument or statement. The person's title must also be listed if it is to appear in the voter's pamphlet statement of argument. Basically, the policy we've adopted and what Senate Bill 137 and Gross reflects is that we will edit the candidate statement or the major argument to match what's in that box, because that is what the individual has signed. Hopefully, you, the candidate, or the campaign manager, or someone has filled in that box in consultation with the endorser so that there's no confusion about what the true title of the organization is or the title of the individual. And candidates at the state level do have an opportunity to fix that, because we'll call you within that 5-day period after the final deadline and say, there isn't a match. How do you want? Can you get a new one that is more accurate?
Fred, can you just give an example of where the problem has occurred in the past? I mean, just why are we having to legislate this?
Yeah. Well, Representative Walker's example, and her,
you don't have to be specific.
It's okay. Was where her opponent had incorrectly guessed at basically the title of one of the endorsers, and when the school official signed the statement of endorsement for the candidate, she had not clarified what her title was, and so there was some misapprehension, certainly in some people's minds, as to whether there'd been a misrepresentation of her station, of her position, and a complaint filed with us, an investigation, and indeed, some people insist on their medical degree being in their name, even though they may have some other station in life as well, and it's that other station that their endorsement is being solicited for and used in a candidate statement, alleviate the concern of individuals that they're being misrepresented by candidates or major arguers in the voter's pamphlet. We've said, as the statute now says, they've got to either have a public statement that's been printed in the newspaper and is referred to by date and title of publication, or they've signed a statement of endorsement. And so that's basically the issue.
And would there be those examples, for instance, if, say, an individual who has a public position, if they don't want to use that public position as part of the endorsement, they're just using their name? This is to clarify that instance as well.
That's right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if the endorser chose not to have their position in public life attached to their endorsement, but they're simply endorsing this measure, pro or con, as an individual, prominent or otherwise in the community, what they fill in that box or what they edit, say the campaign, the Yes on Measure X committee campaign manager faxes them this form and has filled in their public title, and they cross it out and then sign it. We're going to not print that title in the argument, even if the campaign committee had placed it in there. The alternative to this bill is to, and it was proposed, it was an option for the Senate Rules Committee, was to go back to pre-2001 legislation and not have a proscription on the candidate changing names and titles on statements of endorsement, so the pre-2001 legislation. The Senate chose not to do that, but instead to adopt this clarification that we proposed as a way to, as I said earlier, nail it down. It's rather specific and makes it clear that the onus is on the candidate or the campaign committee, measure committee, to get it right with the endorsers, so that there isn't consternation or miscommunication, misunderstanding with people that you want to have in your statements supporting you.
Thank you. Other questions?
I do.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Fred,
yeah.
Just as another example, would this apparent discrepancy go to the detail of, for instance, filled in here was Representative Linda Flores endorsing somebody, and I signed it with my middle initial, Linda D. Flores. So would that invalidate the...
No, and in fact, we, Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, we would print in that person, whoever used your endorsement, print Representative Linda Flores without your middle initial. They may have chosen to eschew your middle initial for word count Because they had something they felt was more important to say than your middle initial. And just because you sign with your middle initial doesn't mean, that just means that you validated the endorsement and what they had in the box. So, but it's a good, that's a good question. And I'll make sure that that's reflected in our procedures for the next voter's pamphlet.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, this isn't really a question, but you could easily have used Phil Barnhart as your example. I do recall that my campaign was on the telephone on a daily basis during the time that we were working on the primary voter pamphlet statement in the last election, because the form that you had used then was unintelligible to us. We could not understand how to fill it out, and so we went through every single one of them on the phone in order to get them right. This form is a vast improvement over the one we used in the primary last time, and I'm very glad to see it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Some other questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Yeah.
And no one else scheduled to testify on this, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 137 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 137. Mr. Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 137 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 137 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, let's call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused. Chair votes aye, and we will start the. Senate Bill 137 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Concerned about consent? Any objection to the consent calendar? Seeing none, so ordered. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 137 and open up a work session on House Bill 3631. And, right, Mr. Honeycutt, come up and discuss your Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Honeycutt. We have prepared the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3631 based on previous conversations we've had with Multnomah County, where they expressed a concern that the bill, as Section 4 of the bill is currently written, may apply to more than just Miss English. What the Dash 1 amendments do is add further criteria. Let me walk you through the criteria very quickly, the existing criteria in Section 4 of the bill, and then I'll go through the additional criteria. The existing criteria are fourfold. Number one, that the current owner acquired the lot or parcel prior to January 1, 1955. So that would be somebody that narrows the scope of the field quite a lot. Assuming that somebody bought the piece of property when they were 20, that would make them 68 right now. And, of course, they'd have to own the property continuously. And I don't know about 1955, but people buying property when they're 20 nowadays is somewhat of a rarity. B, the lot or parcel was zoned as of January 1, 2003 as forest land, so it was as of January 1 of this year, it was in a forest zone. Three, the lot or parcel was smaller than 25 acres, and four, a regulation that was adopted after the current owner acquired the lot or parcel prevents the owner from partitioning or subdividing the property. So you got 1955, smaller than 25 acres in a forest zone. The Dash 1 amendments also add two additional criteria, that the lot or parcel is 2 miles or less outside the city limits of a city with a population of 500,000 or more, which obviously is the city of Portland. And as we testified, Dorothy English's property is 3/4 mile from the city of Portland. F, that there was at least one lawfully sited single-family dwelling on the lot or parcel as of January 1, 2003. So we wouldn't be talking about land that could conceivably be used for something other than rural residence. So the Dash 1 amendments narrow that. They also make the change to everywhere in Section 4 that the current owner appears. It changes it to a current owner. The purpose of that, Dorothy English and her husband acquired the property in 1953. He is now deceased. And so for purposes of her, we wanted the language to read that a current owner of the property, to avoid the argument that, well, the current owners, Mr. English is no longer a current owner because he's deceased. And of course, Dorothy, I believe, has added her her daughter's name onto the deed, so that there's, although there's a change in ownership technically, she has owned the property since prior to 1955. Using A, the word A instead of B, the goal is to make it clear that that she would qualify under these provisions if the committee chooses to adopt them. So we would ask for the dash ones to be incorporated into the bill.
Okay. Mr. Emmett, just curious on the testimony, I think, from Thousand Friends earlier, that portion of this, of what was originally owned, had been subdivided or divided out some way. Will, I mean, is there protection, I guess, to that extent, that where you have currently the lot in Section 4 saying the lot or parcel is larger than 19 acres and smaller than 25 acres, you're not looking at any potential problem of somebody coming back saying that it originally started out as a 40 acre or 80 acre lot?
Chair Doyle, I'm hoping via legislative history that to make the point clear that what we're referring to is the currently owned lot or parcel, not the lot or parcel as it was purchased back in 1953, the currently owned lot or parcel. Dorothy English only owns one piece of property in the entire world, and that's the 19-acre piece that she has, or 19.74-acre piece that she has there in Multnomah County.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Berger.
Yeah, but I have one question. How were they able to divide and sell off half of the first 20 acres, in other words?
Chair Doyle, Representative Berger, the provision that created the state statute that creates an 80-acre minimum parcel size in the state of Oregon was enforced, farm and forest zones, was put into statute in 1993.
Oh,
this was done prior to that.
All right, that explains it. Thank you.
Representative Barnhart, do you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, I do. I'm having a little trouble parsing. And it may be with the amendments, I'm not sure. The lines, the subsection 2 on section 4, lines 35 and through 38. Can you help me figure out what that means?
Yeah, sure. Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, that's narrow. The purpose of the subsection 2 of section 4, lines 34 through 38 on page 2 of the bill, is to narrow the essentially frame the ability of the person who would qualify, what they essentially they could do. What it says, and if the dash ones are adopted, I believe line 34, instead of saying the current owner, would say a current owner, they would be able to partition or subdivide only one lot or parcel, so that if there were somebody that conceivably owned a parcel in one part of Multnomah County and another parcel in another part of Multnomah County, they'd only be able to partition or subdivide one. We think that the language is so narrow that it applies, as we said earlier, to just Dorothy English. But if for some reason it wouldn't, they'd only be able to choose one. Subsection B, they may build a single family dwelling on each lot or parcel. That indicates that that if they are able to partition their lot or their one lot or parcel into and create new lots or parcels, they can put one single family dwelling on each lot or parcel that they create. And subsection C is they can't create more than 8 lots or parcels from the original. And so, in other words, if you have your one, using Dorothy English's example with her 20 acres, she would be able, the maximum number of parcels she would be able to create out new parcels would be 7. 1 plus her, plus 7, the one that she has, plus 7 additional ones. So the average parcel size, using that example, would be about 2.5-3 acres.
Okay. Follow-up. I mean, then I don't understand how, A, on line 35. I mean, this was my confusion. Line 38 seems to say you can end up with eight lots.
Correct.
Line 35 seems to say you can only subdivide one.
Chair Doe,
understand that.
Representative Barnhart, what A does is it says if conceivably a person, Dorothy English, could conceivably have 20 acres here and another 20-acre lot here. What subsection A is designed to do is to say if you have more than one, you can pick one or the other, but you wouldn't be able to create eight lots on your one 20-acre piece and another eight lots on your other 20-acre piece. You can only pick one. We don't think that, obviously, we think subsection A is superfluous because if the criteria is narrow enough, which we think it is, it would only apply to Miss English, and she only owns one lot or parcel in the entire world.
Okay. So if I can follow up, Mr. Chair. A refers to the existing arrangement. C refers to the arrangement you end up with after the operation of this bill.
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, that is correct.
Okay. I understand it. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Other questions, Mr. Honeycutt? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Muir, you want equal time? Discuss this amendment? Okay. Ms. Simplores?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the -1 amendments to House Bill 3631.
Thanks. Representative Flores has moved adoption of the -1 amendments. Discussion? Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really do believe in the regional planning that we have in this state. We're one of the luckiest states, I think, in the nation to have such beautiful resources. And I hate to override our local planning process that we have in place, so I will be a no.
Okay, and further discussion on the -1 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mathlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The good representative makes a good point, but oftentimes regional planning in this case is a broad, big picture plan, and some things get maybe out of whack a little bit, and mistakes theoretically here could be made. And there are times then when there seems to be no recourse, there seems to be no place that the landowner could go except the legislature. There is no other place to that Ms. English could go to. Given the facts of what I've heard, given the information I've heard, I'm going to be a yes on this.
Let's call the roll on the motion for -1 amendments.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative Ford.
Aye.
Representative
Anderson. Aye.
Representative
Berger. Aye.
And Chair Doyle. Chair votes aye. -1 amendments are adopted. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3631 as amended to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3631 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, do-pass as amended recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, call the roll, please.
Aye. Representative Barnhart.
No, I get notice of a possible minority report.
Representative Close.
What's aye?
Representative Forrest.
Aye.
Representative Mona Anderson.
No.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair Doran.
Chair votes aye, and we will ask Representative Garrard to carry this. That ends the work session on House Bill 3631, and open up now a work session on House Bill 2144. Colleagues, this is a bill that we have had public hearing on. Back in March, if you may recall, it's the one where the Secretary of State and the State Treasurer, Director of the Department of Revenue, spoke or provided some form of testimony about this fiscal impact committee. There has been an amendment proposed, and
Mr. Chair, members, you should have a dash 4 amendment. We delivered it to your offices sometime this morning, probably. Yeah.
Right. And Mr. Neal, do you have any comments on...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on the dash 3s or the dash 4s, the dash 4s are identical to the dash 3s, but for addition of the two chairs, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee and the chair of the Senate Ways and Means Committee, and the rest of the bill in regards to a quorum and a majority has been adjusted accordingly for the two additional members, and we have no comment. It may have, through our legal counsel in the AG's office, potentially raised an issue of constitutionality. Again, for the record, Fred Neal at the State Elections Division. But we don't think it's a showstopper, the possibility that legislators serving on a committee that adopts a statement for the ballot might be exercising some executive function, and an analogous case would be where some members of the Supreme Court think that they're writing a ballot title is serving some function that is not judicial in nature, but so it's hard to say how they would judge a challenge to this addition to what is a descriptor and not the measure itself, but its analysis and estimate of its financial impact. We don't think it raises a significant constitutional issue and have no objection to it possible. As the Secretary certainly has no objection.
And Mr. Neal, the currently legislative members participate on other initiative,
yes.
Explanatory statement committees, for example?
They do if it's a referral or a referendum. They don't necessarily if it's an initiative petition because it's two proponents, two opponents. If there happens, one of the chief sponsors of an initiative happens to be a legislator, we will appoint them if they're want. You know, appropriate otherwise. And in many cases, explanatory committees have themselves opted for a legislator rather than a retired judge as the fifth member of an explanatory statement committee. And we've never been cautioned by counsel that having a legislator serve on an explanatory statement committee was inappropriate.
And just to follow up on that, was it your testimony that even drafting different types of statements is an executive function versus
no
a legislative function?
No, I wouldn't say so. It's a committee function by statute that for statements that the legislature itself has created for the process.
Okay. Questions, Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, it's been a while, and I wonder if perhaps this witness or someone else can review for us what the gravamen of this bill is, what this is really about.
Okay.
I mean, we've just heard about the committee, and that's useful. But
mm-hmm.
I've reread the bill, and I'm still concerned that we're actually accomplishing what we want to accomplish here. So maybe you could tell us what this bill does, as you understand it.
And if I can interrupt first, I don't know if in your bill file, if you had the summary that was provided by the proponents that kind of gives a, right, just a summary of the measure. But, Fred, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barnhart, and that is the document that I have... I'm now referring to because it is a consensus of existing and former members of the Fiscal Impact Committees over a period of time in struggling with the existing statutory mandated language of what the committee shall adopt in particular circumstances, that language, that very specific mandate by statute is far too constraining and does not serve the voters well in better understanding some of the nuance of fiscal impact of proposed constitutional amendments or statute that would be on the ballot. And so the committee met over a period of time the committees now are staffed by legislative administration staff, and so legislative administration staff also sat in on some of these meetings, and these were the recommendations that the committee could agree on, that that the committee should have the option of stipulating the fiscal impact if the measure does not take effect, as well as if it should take effect, because sometimes the failure of a measure will have an impact on a state budget or local government budgets. The committee agreed that in some cases, but not necessarily in all, that some further discussion is warranted of underlying assumptions of the direction the economy is taking, or what anticipated increase in public employee salaries would be, or scientific adjustments or market adjustments to a new tax, and people will buy less of what's being taxed thereby, and to try and put that into two sentences that goes on a ballot is too constraining. And so there would be a longer statement if the committee deemed it advisable, no longer than 500 words to go in the voter's pamphlet as well, should there still be a voter's pamphlet in the future. And that then the final major recommendation is that there be a fifth member beyond what is now provided for law that represents local government and has some understanding of local government finance, since very often that's outside the acumen of, and with all due respect, the Department of Administrative Services or the Secretary of State or the State Treasurer, the Director of Revenue.
The I think one of the examples that was brought up in earlier testimony was the initiative on genetically modified foods that actually had no fiscal impact according to the current law, and yet it was fairly clear, you know, that there would have been a substantial impact, but this committee could not have made any kind of recommendation one way or the other without that flexibility. And because of the issue of flexibility, that's where the Ways and Means co-chairs came in, as far, not them personally, but the idea of having them involved in this committee now, that you know, instead of just having the officials that were designated on this committee, that there needed to be some legislative input as well. So it just gives it a little bit more legislative involvement, you know, with the Dash 4 amendments. So anyway, that I think the gist of that. So Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fred, are the Dash 4s all what is on the single sheet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, the Dash 4s are what do incorporate what is on the sheet and adds the co-chairs of Ways and Means to the committee.
I wanted to ask you...
Representative Barnhart is making a hand signal, so that then there would be a seven-member committee.
Okay. I don't have a problem with that. However, I did want to ask you about some of the bullets.
Sure.
You say that they will be considering the effects of companion or contingent legislation not on the ballot. I'm unclear why that's included and what that is, and
okay,
secondary effects of the measures passing or failing. What is a secondary effect? Maybe you could clarify.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Close, the issues there for the committee, and I can recollect actually some specifics, though I can't remember the measure numbers, but let's say it's a debt authorization, constitutional amendment to Article 11 of the Oregon Constitution to increase the authority of the state to incur general obligation debt, bonds for higher education and the like, and that in itself does not have a fiscal impact, because that constitutional amendment does not itself issue the bonds. More than likely, that legislative assembly has also adopted a companion House or Senate bill that authorizes a specific amount of bonds that is will take effect if the people adopt the constitutional amendment. And then the treasurer issues, and I'm looking for the Treasurer's Office, they were here earlier, they then issue the debt. And so it would be nice, even though the companion bill that will take effect if the voters vote yes on the debt authorization will incur $300 million in general obligation debt to the state, and the statute says to the committee, you're supposed to tell the voters what debt service is entailed in the legislation, or what's on the ballot. The committee feels that they can't now talk about that because that's not what's on the ballot. It's the constitutional amendment, not the companion bond issuance bill. So that's one of, and that would also be a secondary effect. Besides companion legislation, it's a good example of a secondary effect that, well, not only are you going to authorize the debt incurrence, the Legislative Assembly has already got a bill in place that's going to go to the Treasurer and Bond Council as soon as you pass, 30 days after the election.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I'm trying to apply this to Measure 28, and I'm, you know, obviously when we voted on that, we had a thick packet of facts that would take, you know, cuts.
Oh, yes.
Add that.
Yes.
And so forth. I'm trying to think on that particular measure, based on your amendments, is there any word limit to, or can you include in the voters' pamphlet? Huge amounts of information, so you're going to be in control on how much information?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, this, the bullets, that recommendation is for the longer narrative version that would not exceed 500 words that would go in the voters' pamphlet only, not on the ballot. The committee has been very scrupulous about limiting its verbiage for the fiscal impact itself, because that goes on the ballot. And in a Mark Sents county, and pretty soon we'll have all 36 counties with Mark Sents ballots and not punch card, that paper is very expensive, and it can only be, the ballot yeses and noes can only be placed in certain places on that ballot for the machines to scan them. And since you start lengthening fiscal impact statements, you're going to start driving the costs of an election, and really probably not doing the voters any great stead by putting far too much on the ballot itself, which is why the committee's the recommended consensus -3 -4 amendments are to have this companion narrative, and it would not exceed 500 words.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not to belabor the issue, Mr. Neal, but on page 2, subparagraph 3, the estimate shall be impartial, simple, and understandable, and may include but are not limited to the following information, blah, blah, blah. My question pertains to simple and understandable, I get. Is there a... impartial, is that in the eye of the beholder, or how do you determine impartiality?
Chair Doyle, Representative Flores, again for Neal, it's, again, probably in the eye of the beholder, but in this case, it's a directive from the legislature by statute to the members of the committee. For an explanatory statement committee, there's this language as well, and that is a grounds for someone who's commented on the draft explanatory statement to appeal to the Supreme Court to say, it's not impartial or it's not understandable, but the fiscal impact statements themselves probably, you know, appropriately so, are not appealable based on whether they're impartial or not, but only whether they're accurate or not, because they are an estimate, and estimates are sometimes rather difficult to come by, and it would be asking probably too much of the Supreme Court to try and second guess a panel of somewhat expert public officials on the accuracy or necessarily the impartiality. But so the only appeal allowed from a fiscal impact estimate for a ballot measure is based on procedural flaw that the committee did not meet in open, did not hear, the secretary did not take testimony on the draft
estimate. It's, the quorum was not present or participate in the adoption of the statement. Those are the only items, basically procedural, that a statement can be appealed on. So I can't guarantee for you that all fiscal estimates in the future or in the past haven't necessarily been impartial or all that accurate. But I do know that the committee does its best to assure that and have taken great pains to talk those issues through and assure themselves that they're doing the best they can. Mm-hmm.
Further questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go to the amendment here, and I'm not sure if you, Chair Doyle, or Fred is the persons to address this to, but on page 4, line 28, it says that except as provided in subsection of this 5 of this section, the original estimate and statement and any revised estimate or statement shall be approved by at least 3 of the members of the Financial Estimate Committee. That's not a majority, and I'm wondering what impact that would have.
Oops. Yeah, good catch.
Do we
sharp eyes?
Yeah, very good.
Just take a minute just to check to see if that's nowhere else. I think we could.
No,
entertain
I
a
yeah,
yeah.
It, Councilman, actually, I know that the dash threes were the dash threes rather than the dash twos because they took that into account earlier. So maybe I need to quick. Because then council used the language a majority of the committee, but it didn't catch it up here.
Let's take a minute. Feeling that legislative council is listening right now, and if we can ask them to come down and address this.
Yes, you see in sub 5, page 5, line 6. That's two or more, because that's where the committee. Well, let's let council explain it.
And then I thought it was maybe done intentionally and was going to try and slip something by it. Obviously, that's not the case. The other thing...
Did you think that?
Oh, I've learned to be
early in the
wary,
session, so.
Very wary. Also, on what is the timing for having an initiative... in, you know, on page 5, under subsection 5, we need to file and certify the state estimates of statements mm-hmm. not later than the 88th day and then in 2 days on the 90th day. I forget where it is.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, is there a timing issue here or is this reasonable?
Chair Doyle, Representative Morris Anderson, there's always a timing issue. These schedules are perfectly appropriate for a primary or general election, and they work. They're somewhat tight. Last session, we asked, and the legislature agreed to allow the committees to start earlier, prior to our certifying initiatives as having sufficient signatures to qualify to the general election ballot, just so that we could get the committees up and rolling and have a head start, especially when there's possibly 28 measures on the ballot. And we're talking about July and August here where people have much deserved vacations scheduled. But 88 days works. What happens for a special election, which is really only in a referral situation, is that then we ask you, the rules committees of the two chambers, to adopt a companion elections bill that truncates dates or has the legislature drafting its own explanatory and fiscal impacts statements so that the whole process can be shortened so that we can get a certified ballot to the counties in time. But 88 days does work. Now, we have to certify the ballot to the counties by the 61st day, which is another issue that will come before you in regards to the next general election and some candidates.
But having the 88th day for the adoption of the statement allows for the appeal to the Supreme Court, and then we are every August of an even numbered year in consultation with legal counsel to the Supreme Court about their vacation schedules and getting some final determination in time to get on the ballot. And the statute also provides that if the Supreme Court has not acted in time, we can still proceed with publication of the voter's pamphlet and certification of the ballot without the financial statement.
Thank you. Mr. Reitlinger.
Mr. Chair, Ted Reitlinger from the Legislative Counsel's Office. It appears...
Direct you to the bottom of page 4, yeah, line 29.
Here's that I was caught in a failure to change the reference in subsection 4 from 3 members of the committee. As Fred pointed out, we did manage to change it there in subsection 5 on page 5. Since we're moving the committee from 4 to 7 members under these amendments. So it seems to me that on page 4, in line 29, that we could amend that sentence to read, except as provided in subsection 5 of this section, the original estimates and statement, any revised estimates or statement shall be approved by the majority of members of the Financial Estimate Committee, which would require at least 4 of the 7 members to approve. And then if you go over to subsection 5, it says that if a majority does not approve, then the Secretary of State proceeds with the estimate.
Okay. Members, we actually have a referral to Ways and Means on this bill because of the potential fiscal impact just with not knowing the voter's pamphlet issue and the requirements that we have here anyway. So I'm wondering, Ted, your recommendation then on handling that as just a conceptual amendment, knowing that we're going to have to get this redrafted anyway. Is that a concern for Legislative Council?
Mr. Chair, if... I'm not sure what your rules are with regard to quote-unquote conceptual amendments. This one seems relatively easy. If you wanted to adopt it, I could give you the stamp of approval. On the other hand, if it's going to the other committee and you anticipate potentially other changes, you might want to wait and let that committee do this amendment as well. Mm-hmm. It's really up to you.
Okay. Committee, it's, I guess, if there's no objection, I just assume you'll go forward with the conceptual amendment just so it's coming out of this committee as we intend it, and then leave it up to Ways and Means. If their only issue is going to be trying to figure out if there is a cost based with the voter's pamphlet statement issue. Representative Barnhart?
Yeah, I just have a question about how we do these things. When we send a bill off to another committee with an amendment on it, is it engrossed before it gets there?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, then, if we made this conceptual amendment to dash 4, that would presumably show up in the engrossed version of the bill. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Other comments?
I like that.
Okay. We then need to,
Mr. Chair, I would advise you to suspend the rules to allow a conceptual amendment, suggest the conceptual amendments to the dash 4s and move the amended dash 4s into the bill.
Okay. So then we are looking to, without objection, to suspend the rules to entertain a conceptual amendment to House Bill 2144-4. Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Rules are suspended. And Mr. Reitlinger, can you walk us through that amendment one more time?
Yes, Mr. Chair. On page 4 of the bill, in page 4 of the dash 4 amendments, line 29, you would delete the phrase least 3 of the.
Or?
Yeah, I would say.
The whole majority.
At least 3 of the, that would come out. And you would insert the words a majority of. I'm sorry. Let's just delete at least 3 and insert a majority.
That works.
So mm-hmm. the sentence would, on line 29 would read, approved by a majority of the members.
Okay. So the motion then is to, on page 4, line 29 of the dash 4 amendments, to delete at least the term at least 3 and replace it with a majority. And
that's it.
Yeah, a majority.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I heard
so moved.
That motion.
Yeah.
Representative Flores, any discussion?
Yes. Amendment.
Any objection? No objection. So ordered. Thank you. Now, Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the dash 4 amendments as conceptually amended.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved adoption of the dash 4 amendments as conceptually amended. Any discussion?
Yes, I have one.
Representative Moss Anderson.
On page 5, page 3, line 13, or actually starts on line 12, when we're adding. We're adding the chair of the House Ways and Means, that's not part of this group as it is in statute now. We're adding the chair of the Senate Ways and Means and a representative of a city, county, or district with expertise in local government finance. Why was that last piece, a representative of a city, county, or district with expertise in local government finance, why was that added?
Yeah, that actually was not part of the dash fours. It was actually the original bill. Had that, didn't it?
Well, yeah. Was it in later?
Oh no, it was. It was part of the, I guess, the original amendments.
Right.
Which was
conceptual part consensus document.
Right.
Chair Doyle, Representative Moss Anderson. If you recall, I went through that in that there was some sense by the extant and former members of fiscal impact committees that they didn't always have expertise in local government finance issues, and the fiscal impact estimates themselves must estimate the impact on local governments.
I remember that. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion about the motion to adopt the dash 4 amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you very much. Excuse me. I just wanted to congratulate the Representative Moss Anderson for her sharp eyes and for picking that up very well. So that was an excellent contribution to our committee today. So thank you.
Absolutely. She'd make a good ball player, wouldn't she?
I've watched her swing at golf club.
We're
I think
done
that's
with
possible.
Oh, that's right. We're done with baseball. Never mind. Representative Barnhart.
Henceforth to be known as Sharp Eyes Laurie.
Okay. Further discussion on the dash 4 amendments. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2144 as amended. Do I have to say as amended as amended? to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. And that it be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Great. Representative Flores has moved House Bill 2144 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and that be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Further discussion? Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be voting no on this. I do think there are several good parts to the bill. I like the expansion of the committee to 7. However, we already have committees that estimate the financial impact if measures pass. I think it's much harder to estimate what happens if they don't pass. And I think it's very difficult to make that simple. And I think it's difficult to make it, impartial. So I will be a no vote on it.
Further discussion? Seeing none, let's call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Votes no.
Aye.
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 And chair votes aye. And we don't need a carrier for this. It's going to Ways and Means. So with that, we are.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
May I have the privilege of voting on the bill that I missed, Senate Bill 137?
You will. Let me first exit from the work session on House Bill 2144. Thank you, gentlemen. And I guess, are there any objections to allow Representative Berger to vote on Senate Bill 137? Seeing none, your vote. Representative Berger?
I vote aye.
Representative Berger votes aye on Senate Bill 137. And any objections to allow Representative Close to vote on Senate Bill 457? Seeing none, Representative Close, how do you vote?
Vote aye.
Close votes aye. With that, we are adjourned.
Alrighty then.